Hello, Yes But Why listeners. This is your host, Amy Jordan. Welcome to Yes But Why, episode 264, my chat with writer and improviser, Roberta Lewis. But first, let me tell you about our sponsors. This episode of Yes But Why podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get your free audiobook download and your 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. This week, I was actually chatting with some mom friends of mine about how we were excited to use our credit this month on Audible. You see, every month when your subscription fee gets paid, you get a credit. So, a new book every month, guaranteed. It's an easy way to keep up with all the book clubs. Go now to audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. You'll get a free audiobook and access to hundreds of books and podcasts, all included with your membership. All that plus a new book every month? It's everything. Get Audible. Yes But Why podcast is also sponsored by PodcastCadet.com. PodcastCadet.com is a company run by myself and my husband to help you find the right podcasting path for you. Guys, you know me. I am clearly the girl who wants you to live your creative dreams. Well, if any of those dreams include podcasting, give me a call. Or, well, you know, go to PodcastCadet.com. Our first consultation is free. Then just use promo code YBY20 and you'll get 20% off the first service or workshop you buy. Let us help you. PodcastCadet.com. This week on Yes But Why, I had the pleasure of talking to Roberta Lewis, writer and improviser from San Jose, California. I had a great conversation with Roberta. There are so many fun improv rabbit holes in our chat. We talk about improvised Shakespeare, the history of improv, and the perfect third beat. Tune in. I now present Yes But Why, episode 264, Roberta Lewis on exploring improv skills and philosophies. Enjoy.
Amy Jordan, and this is Yes But Why podcast. Yeah.
Were you a funny kid that was entertaining your family, or did you do theater, or how did creativity manifest for you when you were younger?
Let's see. I was kind of a class clown, but I don't think anybody was like, oh, you know, he's gonna be a comedian. I don't think I was that person. I was more bookish. I was the kid that brought a book everywhere, even places that you weren't supposed to bring a book. And I had like a little pencil that I would use to underline words that I didn't understand so I could look them up later. I was that kid.
Really?
For example, like when we would have family reunions, my cousins, we would put on little shows for the rest of our family. And my oldest cousin, Joy, she would be like, you know, kind of a producer, director, star, and would assign us all roles, and we'd sing songs and do little sketches and stuff like that. And I had a role in Raisin in the Sun when I was in high school, but that didn't feel like it counted to me. Like it was a fun and frightening experience, but I was not like, oh cool, I'm a theater kid now. I feel like I came to performance pretty late in life. I think, yeah, like not until I had finished college and moved to LA and started taking improv. And then I was like, oh, this whole adrenaline rush that you get when you come on stage. Oh, now I understand why people do this, you know? And so now I'm on board.
I like how you're like, so I didn't realize I was a performer until well into taking improv classes. It was like, okay, cool. How'd you get to that door? Like, you moved to LA. People don't move to LA to become plumbers. You know what I mean? Well, like,
yeah. I mean, I moved to LA to do film stuff, but I was working as a, you know, I was working on set, I was like a camera assistant, working as a grip, and, you know, and I would write and all this stuff. And I initially started taking improv because I was, I was working the graveyard shift as a copy editor, and I was feeling creatively blocked. And, the woman that I was dating had, moved to the East Coast for grad school. So I had just completely free social calendar. So I just filled all my hours. So I had a Groupon. So I started taking an improv class, and in that class, I was like, oh, this is fun. I think I started taking it because I was scared of the idea of taking it. And I was like, oh, this is fun. And in that first class, the teacher was like, oh yeah, it's the same skills as conversation. Right. And I'm like, oh, great. And then he also said, oh, by the way, there are several different improv schools in town, and they all have different philosophies of improv. And I was like, what? Like, I've got to try them all. So for a while I'd have one class like at UCB or something in the afternoon. And then I would have an evening class at my main theater at Westside Comedy Theater. And then I would get out of class at 10 and then go to work. And then be at work all night, and then come home in the morning and sleep for a little bit, and then kind of start again. So for a while I could just fill my calendar with improv. And yeah, it was during that process where I was like, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. This is kind of addictive. I see how people get into it.
Like, again, how you, like, you're weeks or months into having packed your schedule between sleeping, working, and improv, and you're like, hold on, guys, I don't know if anyone knows this, I like improv. And they're like, what?
It was because I initially approached it as more of like a skill based thing. Like, it's like taking karate. Like, you're taking karate classes, but you never think that you're gonna go into a tournament and actually fight somebody. You're like, no, I'm taking karate because that's what people do, and you get these skills, you become stronger or whatever. And so I was taking the classes. I'm like, oh yeah, you know, it makes you more outgoing and it decreases your fear. But then getting on stage was, you know, a whole another level of fear and confrontation and adrenaline and all that kind of stuff. And then I was like, oh, for example, I remember realizing, like, oh, that's why people in bands go out and get trashed afterwards, because it feels like a giant occasion. You know, every time you, for me, every time I went on stage, it felt like it was New Year's Eve. You know, like, wow, I can't believe that this thing was so crazy, regardless of how the show was. So I never had thought of myself as a performer, even though I was interested in some of those things. But maybe a year into the process, I was like, oh, okay, maybe this is a thing. I also initially thought that everybody felt that way. Like, oh, if you took improv, then you will be addicted and you will want to perform. But clearly that's not the case. But yeah.
Oh, I mean, I was like, I feel like it is the case, but I don't know. Maybe I'm good at keeping people around, because I was like, everybody I've ever taught went all the way through the program. I was
once,
like,
they get there.
No, you're right. You're right. Getting through the door is the toughest part, for sure.
Yeah. I was trying to. Yeah, there are people that I was, you know, because the first couple of years I was like that annoying evangelical improv person, like, oh, you gotta try it. Oh, yeah, you have to take a class or whatever. And there's some people I was like my ex-girlfriend, I was like, I will pay your way through level one. Just, you know, and she was like, no, 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 absolutely not. Not even, she just wasn't there yet, which makes total sense, because that's where I was several years before. And then another friend who I never would have thought would have been interested in it, he was like, yeah, I decided to take a class. And yeah, 3 years later, yeah, he's totally got the bug. So I think, yeah, once you're there, you just got to get there.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's almost like we were talking about with, like, audience. It's like some people get it and some people don't. And I'm not worried about it if you don't. It's all right. You got a thing. Yeah. You must have a thing. You know, and, you know, in Austin, there's so many. The fun thing about Austin, one of the fun things is that, like, there are a lot of very tight groups. So, like, there's the improv crowd. So there's that. And then there's running groups, like huge packs of people that run together every day. That's the thing. Yeah. People who ride their bikes, people who ride motorcycles, people who, you know, like to do pottery. There's like big swaths of people who are just obsessed with their thing, and that's what they're into. And I'm like, hey, it's all right. There's other things. If you come to improv and you're not convinced, great. Please get back to watch more shows, but also find whatever your thing is. There's tons of things. Like, you're going to be all right. But I don't know. I mean, one thing that I find fascinating about your telling of this story is the idea that, like, for a while you were kind of just doing it to, as like self-improvement of like, oh, this will help, you know, make me a better writer. This will help me, you know, have more fun, and then I'll be more easygoing at my job. Like,
right.
When you, and you maybe don't know the answer to this question, that's okay. When you like mentally shifted to, I want to be a performer, I'm going to put effort into doing this in a more professional way, do you think that changed the way you felt about it?
The way I felt about the art form itself?
Yeah. It was for funsies and now it's your job. How did that change for you?
No, because I think I always, it's not quite accurate to say that I always thought of it as my job, but I feel like I always took it seriously. And I think I probably credit my first couple of teachers for that, because their attitude was, you know, if you're going to do something, you might as well do it well. And the work that's required, I mean, and also to be fair, I'm a bit of a you know, self-help and productivity book junkie anyway. So all those little terms and paradigms like facing your fear or the dip and all that kind of stuff, all that stuff is bouncing around in my head all the time anyway. And so much of the language used during those first classes kind of fell into that point as well. Like, for example, a teacher said to me, when you hate your style of performing and you're ready to give up, that usually means that you're about to level up, because you are recognizing your negative patterns and you have to do something in order to move to the next level, right? Things like that. So right from the beginning, I always was like, well, I would like to do this correctly. I would like to be as good at this as I can be. But I was focused more on, I think, the little kind of, the sort of flag, validation points along the way, right? Like, oh, first you graduate your theater's improv program, and then you audition and get cast in a show, and then you hopefully you get the better time slot and blah 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 blah, right? And so I think at first I was thinking of it in terms of that, like progression through the. Oh, actually, here's it. I remember reading about somebody else, their approach to success. And so it was this guy who was, I think he was like a rapper, and he would go to this theater called the Pyramid, and he would and he would perform, and then the more of a fan base he would get, the better kind of gigs he would get, and then finally when he got the, like, say the 9 o'clock slot on Friday, which is the top slot or something, then it would be time for him to leave and find another venue in which to sharpen his skills. And he would call it pyramiding it, like, oh, let's go pyramid it up, right? And I thought of it that way. I'm like, oh, I'm gonna rise to the top here, I guess, and then I'll figure out what the next step is. And then maybe a couple of years in, I think I had a coach that was like, you know, yeah, I think you should probably start taking this seriously now. And then that was when I started to think of myself, I'm like, oh, okay, I am a performer then, and where else am I gonna do this, or what do I want out of this kind of thing? And so that process is actually only a couple of years old for me.
You mentioned that when you first started and someone was like, hey, there's a lot of theaters here and they all have different ways of looking at improv, you were like, let me get into it and take every class in every theater, which was what I found out when I was doing my Google stalking of you. And I was like, whoa, that's a lot of lessons, right? So clearly between that and the note you mentioned up top about underlining words in books you didn't know, which was like adorable. for a tiny child? Like, come on. But so you're such a voracious learner, huh? You're like super into soaking it up into your brain. Was the pyramiding that you did sort of like, you know, having on your resume, like, did all the classes at this place, check, did all the classes at this place, check, like, did that help you or make you feel like you were moving up in the world?
I didn't think of improv in terms of resumes then. It was more like if two different places have completely different takes on what improv is, either somebody's wrong or they both are missing something key. And the only way to know what that is to take classes at both places and find out what works. You know what I mean? And I still feel that way. I do feel like each, a lot of theaters can have like a dogmatic approach to whatever their theory is or whatever the dominant theory at that time of like whoever's running the theater at that time may believe that, oh, character-based stuff is our thing, or emotion-based stuff is our thing, or game-based stuff is our thing, whatever. So that might be, the curriculum might be very heavy on that part. And if I want to be able to play with anybody, then I felt like, oh, it's important to get a taste of everything. So I don't think I know something I don't know.
Do you think that there is one empirical, like, improv that there is to be known? And because you were saying, like, different theaters have different approaches and somebody's missing something and or they're not getting something. Do you think there's like a, this is what improv is, and every theater is just doing a vague suggestion of it? Or
no, I think it's closer to like, say, cooking or something, because I feel like the kind of improv you do and the kind of rules you follow, I think that is should be determined by what your goal is, right? And so for some people, their goal is to just have everyone in the audience doubled over with laughter. That's their goal. And then other places is like, oh, our goal is to, you know, explore these themes, or our goal is to perform a hour-long show that if you sat down and watched it, you would think it was a scripted play and you would have to be told that it was improvised. Like, depending on what your goal is, the rules you follow are going to be different. And a lot of theaters can get to the point, I think, where they feel like, oh yeah, Italian food is the only kind of Italian food there is. And, you know, you don't use peanut sauce in Italian food. So what are you doing using peanut sauce in my scene, dummy? You know what I mean? Mm. And it's like and it's easy to take that stuff personally. But once you go to a bunch of different places, you're like, oh, I see, it's relative. So I'm not going to take it personally.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Interesting. It's funny because the next thing I was going to ask you about was like, where was your home theater? But I feel like that's almost exactly what we were talking about. Like the idea that it's like, if you have something that you consider a home theater, you're probably like, hey, get your peanut sauce out of my lasagna. But, you know, if you're more like, oh, I've checked out the whole buffet, you're not going to be like, I'm confused as to why you brought peanut sauce to this party.
Right. Or even just like it helps so much in terms of knowing which notes to take and which notes to politely set aside. You know what I mean? Like, you might get a note where like, I can't believe you did that. That's ridiculous. I'm like, oh, that's because you come from a different paradigm of improv than I do. So I understand what you're saying, but I don't need to incorporate that note because I know that we're different styles. You know what I mean? Obviously there's like, I don't like to be like, oh, I'm not that kind of improviser, so I don't do that. Like, I try not to do that. I'm not a fan of that, of that kind of like way of thinking about it. But it's like if someone is, you know, yeah, if I'm making a Thai dish and it involves peanut sauce and they're like, you should never put peanut sauce in a Thai dish. And I'm like, oh, you think that Thai food doesn't exist. That's why you gave me that note. So I will allow that. You know, and I don't need to fight for this thing because we're just in different places.
Yeah, totally. I love the cooking metaphor. I think that helps a lot. I feel like that's going to help me like across the board when I'm thinking about improv, you know, because I talk to people from all over the world and they all have different points of view. And, you know, there's a lot of, did you know that they use peanut sauce? And I'm like, I do. I'm aware that they use peanut sauce. Yeah.
Yeah.
I occasionally use peanut sauce myself. Really? Really? You find it helpful? Yeah. Is that something you can do? I mean, you know, I'm pretty good at it. Yeah. I'm just saying, you don't have to use it. No problem. Yeah. No problem.
Right?
Yeah.
I remember being in the theater early on and being told by a teacher like, oh yeah, over there at that theater, you know, they do stuff like, you know, break the fourth wall or like, you know, speak out. We don't do that here. That's ridiculous. And I remember being there in class, being like, oh, of course. Why would anyone do that? And then going to that theater later on and being like, oh, it makes total sense. They're trying to do something different than you're doing. Now I understand why they would do it. I'll make sure that when I'm at this theater again, I won't do that because I know they don't like it. But, you know, it's cooking, right?
When I was at my original theater, they told us that we were not going to take suggestions. So we learned how to do improv with no suggestions of any kind. And having come up in that, it seemed like a good idea. And to be honest, it's a little hard to go the other way to like reincorporate the idea of it, even though it's like so the norm, right?
Yeah.
But the people who came up with that rule apparently didn't give it much thought, whereas I'm a teacher who has to sell this, so I had to give it a lot of thought and like give it a reason and help the students embrace it, right?
How did you position it?
Well, the way that I would teach it was that a lot of times in improv, they will get a suggestion to, you know, kickstart your brain to get the thoughts rolling for your show, and also to show the audience the connectivity of how the ideas come together. I said, but we're going to try to do improv without a net. So like, we're not going to give you a suggestion. We're just going to tell you to be connected, and you're going to have to develop whatever your starting point is from what happens first. And so we just make the first scene essentially what would become later, as I like learned more from other theaters, what a suggestion is. Like, it'd just be like, whatever happens in the first scene then begets everything else.
Right.
And that's fine. And everyone would just be like, all right. And it also helped them to be, I think, those of them that I know who went to other theaters, a little bit more free with when they got suggestions, because like sometimes people get suggestions and they feel like locked in and they don't know what to do. And they're like, what do you mean bread? I don't know anything about bread. I guess I'll be a baker. I am a piece of bread. Like, and you're like, okay, seriously, what does bread make you think of? Butter? Great. Who cares? Yeah. Let's go. Like, so it helped them kind of be more easygoing about it. And I just kind of made them feel like it was a rock star move. Like, it was like, listen, guys, some people need a suggestion. You guys don't. Your brains are already primed. You're ready.
You guys are the SEAL Team 6 of improvisers. We don't need a suggestion.
Suggestion?
Yeah.
We don't need a warrant. We need a suggestion. We just go in.
We're the good.
Get it done. Yeah, we're the good guys. Oh man. Yeah, you know, I mean, everybody finds wherever they learned first to be their like bedrock, and then and then hopefully they're able to open up their minds. Like I was talking about earlier, artists have a wider breadth of emotion and I think a wider breadth of empathy, such that if they really are open to learning what improv is, they will be open to, you know, learning all the different formats. I mean, I'm always like, wait, there's a new way to do this thing? Tell me, because I definitely don't feel confident ever. So let's give me more tools.
I mean, I think it's definitely one of the tricky things about improv is that because there's so much room to humiliate yourself, it's completely natural to want to protect yourself, right? And that's why, rules are very comforting that way, right? And you're like, oh, I, I was told that you shouldn't use a suggestion, so I'll never use a suggestion, and that way I won't embarrass myself. You know what I mean? But it's like, spoiler alert, you still will at some point. That's unavoidable. But like, but yeah, it's like you have to be willing to, you have to be willing to fall on your face if you're going to keep learning and improving. So
yeah,
what are you gonna do?
I think the hard part about that is the idea that it's like, you're going to be fine. You're going to be fine later. When you are embarrassed, you're still embarrassed.
Yeah.
It's still not good. Yeah. But try to rest in the pleasantness that everyone has also experienced this, right?
Yeah.
There are definitely a handful of things that I am have been fine going through in my life because I was aware that most people had also gone through them, you know what I mean? Where it was like, oh, this is terrible. That is what they were talking about. I see now.
Yeah.
All right. You know,
I remember, talking to students about the idea that like, eventually it'll be your turn. So be kind when people screw up on stage, you know what I mean? When they say the wrong thing, because that'll be you at some point. You know what I mean? So try to keep that in mind. And also too, I think that the danger is so much of what makes it thrilling. You know, if it wasn't, if you didn't have the risk of humiliation, I don't think the adrenaline high would be anywhere near as sharp.
Yeah. For me, I like to let them, for me, I think the goal is less to like recover from someone's mistake as much as, weave whatever that is into the world such that the audience has no idea that anyone thought it was a mistake. Like, like if I'm always telling them, like, the worst thing you can do is let the audience know you don't like that idea.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's and when I say the cardinal sin of improv.
Oh yeah.
Like,
you don't want to toss people's ideas under the bus. Definitely not.
Absolutely not. You can later be like, Roger, another bus? Seriously, why do we always have to be in the bus? Stop it. That's fine. Right? But don't do it on stage.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. And when I say mistake too, to be clear, I don't mean like, you know, I was your mother and you labeled me as your sister. I don't mean that stuff. I mean like stuff when you have alienated an audience. You know what I mean? When like, you know, one of those mistakes that like that require a conversation after the show, that kind of stuff. You know what I mean? That's what I'm talking about. And the idea that like, yeah, when you're just making stuff up, sometimes you like, you know, like certain, like this is a mini example of that, which is, I was in a scene a couple years ago. We're on a house team, and it was me and this other performer, and our story on the Herald was that we would have these job interviews. At the end of the job interview, we would end up both murdering the person who came in to apply for the job. Right? I don't even know where the game came from. That was the game. Whatever. We're two beats into that, and then one of the other storylines. One of the other performers who had the most sweet and innocent and lovable character. And then she entered our scene in the third beat, and we're playing the scene. And the whole time I can feel the audience hatred, and we're moving towards the area and this is where we would choke her to death. And I'm like, we can't. And our coach is up at the back of the theater, you know, behind the lights. And he was telling us afterwards, the whole time I was like, don't do it. You cannot do this. Do not do this. You know? And we could feel it. And I guess the idea is like, when you're on the verge of doing something that will make the audience hate you. Sometimes you do that thing because you don't realize what you're doing, and everyone's like, how could you do that? Obviously, in retrospect, you know, that was a terrible thing for you to do. And I say, your turn will come. Eventually, you'll be in a situation where you're like, I didn't mean to open a scene with a trunk full of dead babies or something like that. I don't know how we got there. I apologize, but yeah,
that's like, a classic opener. That is a standard level one. If you don't have a body in a trunk in a level one scene, you have about 17% of level one scenes are in funerals. Okay, so There's that. Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny. I'm listening to you tell this story, and I was like, no, the right thing to do was murder her and enjoy the hell out of it, to have the most fun murdering her that you can have, and really right. let the audience know how much you don't like it, like how much right. they don't like it. Oh, right, is right. this not good? You don't like right. that? Really?
Right.
Yeah,
right.
you knew it was coming. I didn't make her come in this room. You right. know me. I'm and this that, guy.
That is where the, I feel like that is where the SEAL Team 6 vision of an improv team comes from. Because it's like, I'm like, because I've been on teams where it's like, well, we're all on the same page. We're going to kill her at the end of the scene, right? Everyone's like, yeah, yeah, yeah. They may hate us, but this is what we're doing. Versus like when different people have different ideas of what improv is, what improv is for, what they're doing there, what your role in the team is versus theirs, and all that kind of stuff. And so then, you know, this is all, you know what I mean? And when I look back, I'm like, yeah, there would have been fallout had I murdered her in that scene enough that I'm like, that's cool. I'm cool with not murdering her.
I did a sketch show, and I was like the head of the sketch show. And
yeah.
always was I killing everybody off. Always. When it was the worst choice in the world, I was like, yeah, we are. Because to me, it was like the
artist.
Completion of the joke or nothing.
Yep.
And I was like, you stare them in the face and you do it. Like, because what I enjoy is when they know it's coming. When the audience know, they're like, oh, no. Oh, and you can hear them already go like,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, no, it's not going to go. And that's when I start like breaking the fourth wall and it's like, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
I'm going to do it. Like,
I get a charge out of that too. Those moments where you're like, where you can stand up in front of the audience and be like, look, we're all here. We're having this experience together. Let's all just calm down and enjoy this for a second. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. You know, it further highlights exactly what we're talking about, which is like, there's 1,000 different ways to look at improv.
Oh, yeah.
There's 1,000 different ways to look at every scene. There's 1,000 different ways to like embrace what the best choice in that comedy movement was. Like, God, we could talk comedy to death about like, okay, but what's the proper third beat? Like, you know what I mean?
That's when I jump right out of the car. I'm like, please, please. You won't know the proper third beat until you have done it. And you can look back and you're like, oh, that was the wrong third beat. Or we did exactly what we needed to do, you know?
Yeah. That's the beauty of when I do sketch writing is I was like, we can rewrite this, you guys. Like, let's just pick an ending and then we'll read it. And if we're like, meh, then we find a new way to end it, right?
Yeah.
That's why we kept killing everyone off at the end. That's pretty much what happened. We did like a lot of shows, like mostly Halloween shows, let's be clear. So it's not like I'm always murdering people. Maybe a little. But like at the end of at least a couple years, Halloween shows, the audience would leave with all of us dead in the room.
Oh, yeah. No, I love... I'm on a team called Pickup Game, and the team was formed just basically so that we could sort of behave badly on stage and not face consequences for it, because we're like, oh, well, we're on the same page here. And routinely, we would end shows with just bodies strewn all over the entire, you know what I mean? Playing death scenes are fun. It's they're
hilarious.
Just really fun.
Yeah. I mean, my big inspiration for death scenes is going to be Paul Reubens in the Buffy the Vampire Slayer movie. You know, like every vampire in that movie dies quickly. It's just like a stab and a poof. But he is like, hey, and then he like lays down and he gets back up. Like, it's hilarious and it's great.
Yeah.
And it also has, it's so... Like, why is it there? You know what I mean? Like, they're right in the middle of some action, and they just pause for this comedy moment. But I was killing it. You're killing it, Paul Reubens. You're doing it. Like, but I
one line I remember from him in that movie was, kill her a lot. That's the one. That's the one line I remember.
Oh, man. Yeah, so fun. So when did you change your... you know, vibe from performer taking all the classes, soaking it up, learning, being like top performer, being in all the troops to teaching. Like, how did you adjust to that? And also sort of side question to it, like, how do you feel about the ego of it, right? Because there's, I'm on stage, look at me, and then there's, yeah, I'm a teacher, and sometimes that can be a step down or kind of a lateral move. What do you think?
I mean, like, I enjoy teaching, and I feel like the teaching experiences I've had have always kind of popped up somewhat unexpectedly. So, like, I had taught in other ways before. Like, I was like, I've TA'd before, and I taught like at prep schools and stuff, and like SAT prep and stuff like that. And I substitute taught or whatever. And I like teaching when, students are, engaged. Like, I think it's super fun. And then, so when I was going through this whole taking classes and Rise of the Theater and all this kind of stuff, and I took a job in Japan. So I was there for like 8 months. And I went there, and some people were like, oh, we know some folks out there, you know, check out this person, check out that person. And I went and found a meetup, an improv meetup, and I got into the sort of the expat improv community in Tokyo. And I met two of your previous guests, Mike Staffa and Christiane Brew.
Yeah.
And Christiane was putting together a talent show where people, and so she picked me to coach their team for this show. So that was my first like sort of coaching kind of thing. And so I was, and I found it, number one, super fun, but also it made it easier for me to understand my own play. And I got way more out of it than I would have. Like, yeah, I love teaching improv, honestly. Like, there was a period where I was chasing teaching posts just because I was like, oh yeah, no, I love it. And I can make money that way. All this whole thing. But there was, like you were saying, I think a bit of an ego stroke thing about that too, because I was like, why do I care so much? Why am I so disappointed if it doesn't happen? And I was like, oh, this is in the wrong place in my brain now. I need to sort of disengage with the importance of that. And that was after I had, like, you know, I was like TAing for Jay Sukow and for Annie O'Connor and for all these people. And after that period, and I'd done some coaching as well. And I was like, you know what, I need to focus on, yeah, my own development and what it is I'm actually trying to sort of get out of this. And I think that I was focusing on it so that I didn't have to think about what I was going to do with this whole thing. And it was right around that time when I had a couple of conversations with directors, and it would boil down to like, how come you're not taking this more seriously? You know what I mean? Like, you should be doing the things that people who are actors are doing. You are an actor, by the way. And I never kind of thought of myself as that. And it's only in the last couple of years that I've been kind of leaning into that.
Yeah. The reason why I brought up the ego thing was not because of anything that like you and I had talked about, but like, I find that New York, LA, Chicago, and Austin, sorry I'm including us, but it's a big improv city. There are a lot of like, there's a lot of competitiveness in improv, not so much in the like my show's better than your show, so much as like my show represents a better thing in town than yours does, right? When people say Austin improv, they think of us, that kind of thing. And I feel like they do that in LA, and they do that in New York, and you know what I mean? Everybody's trying to be like the cool one. And I noticed that you're everywhere, right? And sometimes people are cool with that, and sometimes people are not cool with that. So I just wondered, like, you know, people have given, you know, can give you a hard time sometimes about like, oh, you're going to that theater? I mean, my personal experience was in a rough place, because the people who ran my theater were very like wanted to keep all of us tight and never yeah. let us go. And they were like, don't ever go to those other theaters or do anything. Yeah. And it was only a few years after. And I was like, that doesn't feel right, but I'm going to just go ahead and be okay with it for a little while.
Yeah.
And then after yeah. a while, I was like, okay, I can't. That's not okay.
Yeah.
That's not something yeah. that's right to do or say to people. But that yeah. doesn't mean it doesn't happen. You know, so your situation, though, like, I like the idea that I understand how it feels to be constantly acting and performing and then also have some outside person tell you that you're an actor. It happened to me as well. They were like, but you're performing all the time. And I was like, I'm. Oh, yeah. I mean, I get sure. Yeah, I guess yeah. so. Like, that's how I got an acting agent. And I was just like,
yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, you're right. I probably should do that. Right. And it yeah. was just like, I never thought of myself as that kind of thing, you know, especially even in the teaching, which I've sort of gone back to since having a child. And I like it because it makes me feel helpful. Yeah. I'm like facilitating other people's journeys. I'm like showing people to this amazing land that I've seen. Hey, I'm like a tour guide to improv land. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Come yeah. on in. It's pretty cool in here. Maybe you can yeah. find a spot. Who knows? Real estate's kind of crazy.
And but there's a therapeutic dimension to it too, I feel like, because I feel like so much of the lessons, I feel like when you're teaching improv, you're, in a way, you're teaching just how to pay attention and listen, how to be empathetic, how to listen before you talk. You know, you're teaching ways to be a more functional human in a community. And I feel like as you have to come up with, you know, analogies or lessons or in order to drive these things home to people, number one, I feel like you're doing a service that needs doing. And it also changes you as well.
Yeah. I feel like too, the experience of having to translate notes to people, like we were talking about, like telling people things maybe they don't want to hear. And also like dealing with tough stuff when it comes up, like that's a really important skill to have as a person in life. Like if you can say to people in an improv room, like, okay, guys, let's talk about why that was not okay. Right. And then let them talk. I feel like that's going to make it a lot easier in, you know, when you're at Thanksgiving and your parents say something or your aunt says something and you're like, okay, we're going to have a chat about why Aunt Patty can't say that anymore. Okay, guys? Right. All right. Right. You know, it like opens you up to having these hard conversations. Because like we were talking about before, like this idea of like acknowledging that there's going to be embarrassment, acknowledging that there's going to be tough times. Also, when you're the teacher, acknowledging that you might have to have rough conversations with people, right? Weird things where they like think they're doing the right thing and you're like, okay, I see what you're saying, but no, we cannot do that.
I often find too that a lot of times, you know, when I'm watching a scene, say, go poorly, and I ask them, well, how did you feel about that? Nine times out of ten, I feel like they have a sense that something has gone wrong. You know what I mean? Like they were trying to do something. It didn't work out the way they wanted to. And it's like, okay, well, what were you trying to do? And perhaps this approach would make this a little easier for you kind of thing. You know, I feel like true out of the blue obliviousness is, I mean, it definitely shows up, but I don't feel like it's the rule, you know?
The other thing is like, if you've gotten all the way into an improv class, you've paid for it and you are there.
Yeah.
You're already a few steps into you're going to be fine dealing with some rough comments about how you shouldn't be weird to women or whatever versus a person who would never sign up for an improv class. Like,
right.
like That's the hard part. And that's actually usually how I open up like my level one classes. I was like, first of all, let's agree to be nice to each other. Just let's start mm-hmm. out with that as an agreement together. And then secondarily, let's agree that like probably everybody in here is nice because we all agreed to take an improv class. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Nobody signs up for meanies rarely sign up for improv classes. You take a stand-up class, you better watch out. There's probably some meanies, but not improv. Yeah. No.
Yeah.
Improv's so quote unquote lame to meanies, they would never take it. Yeah. They just want to make fun of us, and I'll take it. Please make fun of me. Have a great time. I hope you're sad. Oh wait, you are. Yeah. Okay, see ya.
I definitely feel like a lot of those things that can come off meanie a lot of times, I feel like people have not paid attention to those parts of themselves, right? So like, for example, in year one, I was like, oh, every time I do a scene involving a romantic relationship, it is like, you know, cynical and abusive, and like, what do I have to unpack there? You know, like, how come all the dads are bad? What's up with that? You know what I mean? And and I feel like, yeah, like when you show up, you may not know what your hangups are until you play them out in class a few times, you know?
Yeah, but even that, like, true meanies aren't trying to unpack anything. True. You know, I mean, like you're not a meanie if you have some weird things and then you work through them and you're nicer. Like, no, you're just a human being. That's just what happens. If you're like, you know, storming the Capitol, then, you know, you're probably not gonna go through like a level one improv and be like, you know what, guys, I really feel like maybe we should give everyone a chance to have what they to say what they want. I don't know.
You should sentence them all to like 3 years at UCB or something.
Guys, what do you think? Hey, UCB doesn't have a space. All I'm saying is, guys, all jails? I think it could be cool.
Maybe.
I'm just saying, think of the cash. It would be a cash cow. If you just went in and you were like the class in every jail... Forget it. I'm erasing this whole thing. Roberto, you and I are stealing this idea, and we are going to be millionaires. We're going to sell ourselves to jails, and we're going to be like, hi, we're going to come in and do improv classes. Who wants to talk? Hey, guys, put that shiv down.
I taught in a jail once.
Me
and
too.
Like, I think that would, yeah, I thought that would be, I think that would be a fertile place for improv. You know what I mean? It's like, people got feelings.
Yeah. Plus, they like to laugh. They're into laughing, you know, not a lot of people trying to make them laugh. So when you're there making a joke, gosh, they appreciate it.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah. No, I also went and did a show in a jail, and I was just like, yeah, why don't we do this all the time? Like, this is the crowd, right? Like, talk about captive audience. Like, they were just into it, you know? And they were, like, picking up on every joke. Oh, second beat, I get it. Like, they're in it, you know? And I was like, who are these guys? Yep. Like, where are they on a Saturday night?
Learners, man. Yeah,
right? I mean, they weren't coming to the shows beforehand. They were robbing banks. And now here they are, you know? But. Yep. Oh, that's so funny. I bet we're not going to do it, any audience members that might be listening and think that's a good idea. So if you can do it, because A, the people in the jails would really appreciate it, and B, it might actually help humanity. So do it.
Yeah.
There's enough jails for all of us, guys. I'm sure we could swing around and do a little dance and teach them how to yes and maybe that might help. Who knows? Or not. But, you know, they'll have one funny day that they can then harken back to when things are sad. So, you know, that's all right. That's all right.
Teaching people to listen and look deeper is always a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Plus, like, sometimes, like, even just being able to imagine the world outside of yourself, like, can really help get you out of a rut. I have had some tough days, some, like, you know, I don't know how I'm going to, you know, having like a bad job day and then going to an improv class, and then all of a sudden you're like, I am cleansed. I am ready to be a human again. I can handle this, because, you know, if you can relax for a moment and just make improvised rolls with your fellow baker on stage and chat about whatever, like, yeah, great, you know, yeah, relax, enjoy that.
Or just being in a room laughing at, you know, people's abandoned bits or something like that. Like, that's, I'm always going to feel better after a little bit of that.
Yeah. I do love bits. God, I love them so much. Like when it goes too far, and here's the thing. I mean, I'm often, it's always like a meeting, and I'm usually the person in charge of the meeting, and then the bits go really long. So I'm usually the, like, okay, guys, I get it. We get it. And I'll play my part, but I do like the bits. I do like the bits.
Yeah.
Even online. Yeah. Oh my God. Oh goodness. Okay. So you were talking about how you were getting into being an actor, and, you know, people were like, hey, by the way, I don't know if you know, but you're an actor. So how have you embraced that? And, you know, what have you been doing to kind of focus your creative energy on acting?
So the last year or so, I started doing a lot of work at improv theater. So that's primarily genre and narrative based improv. So there's a lot more encouragement towards, you know, towards acting technique. Most of the people that I'm doing scenes with are self-identifying actors who are taking acting classes when they're not there. And so there's always this self-imposed pressure to kind of up my game in that respect. So, you know, and again, the whole learner thing, my approach to literally any problem is to go and buy a bunch of books about it and read it. Like, it's to the point where it's ridiculous. Like, oh, I have a date on Wednesday, I better read this book about, you know, cultural communication or something. But yeah, like, I'm reading the books and, you know, trying to take classes and whatnot. And also just try to figure out the terrain. Like, cause so for years I was just, you know, yeah, oh, cool, here's a show, or here's a team, cool, I'll be a part of it. But the all of the sort of infrastructure around auditions and callbacks and self-tapes and all that stuff, I've just been trying to learn that stuff relatively recently. So I feel like that seems to be almost as much of a craft as the craft, you know?
Yeah, auditioning is definitely a different craft than actually doing acting. Yeah.
And the rituals and the, like, what things mean, you know what I mean? Like, the whole, like, you know, like when you know, you meet with an agent, like, oh yeah, we really like your stuff. Yeah, we should totally, oh, 100%, dude. Yeah, I'll call you on Thursday. And then you never hear from them again. Like that whole thing, I had to have my virginity taken a couple of times that way, where I'm like, oh, okay. It's a different culture. So
figuring
all that out, you know, and trying to, obviously through all that stuff, not lose sight of the moments of performance are what it's actually all about, and everything else is not decoration, but they're just not the thing itself. And so to kind of focus on that part of it that gives me joy, so I don't have to get wound up in, you know, I've been rejected again, like all that stuff, which I know is part of it, but yeah
that can be hard. That is a rough part of the whole situation, especially now, because it's so much less direct. You know, you're doing a self-tape, you send it to a WeTransfer, and then you never hear back from anyone again. As opposed to you met a person and looked in their face.
Yeah.
And then you never saw them ever again. Like, that's, it's different. And for a second, I have this moment with a human, and I'm like, oh, you and me.
Yeah.
We're humans.
Yeah.
Together.
Yeah.
Right now. That's the hard part about Zoom for me, is that part of my superpower is in connecting with people, like, in person. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I try really hard. And I've started to do, like, right now we're doing Zoom with video, and I haven't always done this, right? And now I'm trying to, because I feel like I need that I need to connect a little bit more.
Like, oh, so before you would conduct interviews audio only?
Audio only. Audio only. But yeah. About halfway through the pandemic, I became starved for human faces. So now, now I need to see people. And also, I'm starting to interview way more people internationally and learn more about international cultural things. So I find it easier to look in a person's face to gauge.
There's so much information there too, you know?
Yeah.
You want to know how what you're saying, how it's landing, what you're saying. And, you know, there's a little bit of a lag and there's no direct eye contact, but there's still information. Like, oh, am I losing them? Am I? Oh, she didn't like that. All right, let's change course a little bit. You know, that's all important.
No, yeah, the no direct eye contact is super weird. I'm just staring into the camera and occasionally looking up at you, and I'm like, like, no, this is disconnected. But you know, it's the best we can do. And but there's something to be said about connecting in person. Now, you know. Side step of what we're talking about, are you auditioning for theater or are you auditioning for film?
I'll audition for things that pop up in my path, and then outside of that I'm auditioning for commercials. So for example, I just finished season one of this improvised medical drama show called Heartbeats. It's kind of like an improvised version of sort of like a Grey's Anatomy type soap opera kind of deal. And someone referred me to audition for it. It wouldn't have occurred to me, but someone was like, "Oh, I think you'd be a fit. You should talk to them." And so I'm like, "Oh, okay, great." And part of what I'm working on in general is to be a little bit more proactive about stuff like that and to kind of believe in myself a little bit more and kind of go after things that aren't obviously a good fit. But I think that's just part of the learning curve too, I guess.
Sure. Sure. I love commercials. I think commercials are really fun.
Mm.
I've been in a couple of commercials myself and I find them very entertaining because they always say they want improvisers, but by all intents and purposes, they don't really need improvisers. They're not really looking for anyone to improvise anything. They're looking for a sort of like a buoyant, playful situation.
Energy.
So when they're looking for improv, they don't want you to change the words they've written. No.
Right.
They just want you to like change the tone or like make it seem more fun or funny.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay. And it took me a little bit to realize that that's what that meant. Because they'd be like, yeah, try to improvise. And I was in this commercial one time and my line was the sales line.
Right.
You know what I mean? And I was like.
Progressive has slashed its rates by 50%.
Yeah, I was like, what? Right. I don't think. I was like, but I have to tell the audience what they're getting for how much money. I don't know how to improvise that. Like, I can't do that. I'll change the tone of my voice, but I can't make new words work out for this situation. Oh, man. But I love commercials. I think they're so fun. And I love watching them for... I like watching new actors in commercials, to be honest with you. Like, I'll watch, we got Hulu with ads, and that's my only commercials. And when I watch a series of commercials and, like, I see the same actor in a couple of them, I'm all like, look at that. Because it's like, how random that these two commercials got sent to me with this same random person. And I'm all like, and I'll be like, good for you, dude. Look at this. You know, and not like people like Flo and Progressive, you know what I mean? Like
clearly we're
gonna see her. She's in all the commercials, right? But at the same time, like when you see somebody random and you're like, wait a minute, wasn't that the guy who was just eating cereal a second ago?
And it's so exciting. I am that annoying person that will be in the bar and like will point at the screen because one of my improv teachers is in a Michelob ad or something like
that.
Oh,
there
it goes. Yeah.
I love it. Are you kidding me? Oh my God. I am such a like name dropper of random people don't know. Like, I'm all like, okay, so there was a guy and he was in the third episode of this thing and he plays the guy who delivered the pizza. See, the guy who delivered the pizza, and he was the guy who was in the show with me when I was living in New York and I lived in Brooklyn, you remember? And they're like, this took so long to get to. But I was like, no, it's important because my life is now on TV. That's my roommate. You don't live with him. I did 20 years ago. I live with that guy.
the part that I always end up adding is the idea that, like, oh, when you see somebody on a show, and they have like a line, like, you know, or two lines or whatever, I'm like, that person is probably, you know, the superstar of their theater in whatever town they're from. You know what I mean? Like, no idea what it takes just to get to where they're at right now. You know?
Yeah. I know. Whenever we're watching like one of the Marvel series and there's like one random guy who swings in and he's like, yeah, we got coffee. And I was like, his mom is so proud of him.
Oh, yeah.
I'm like, my God, look at that. He just said that so good. Good for you, buddy. Yes.
And then only that, he's been doing like late night shows for the last 15 years, you know?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Begging people to come see his group. Yeah.
Oh, my God. I love it. Yeah. I mean, I love all of it. I sit there with IMDb open while I watch television every night. Not a joke. Nice. I know everyone in all the shows. Like, I'm like, she seems really familiar. Hold on. Oh, yeah, we watched her three nights ago. She was in, you know, like.
yep. That's a whole new mode of watching. Like, I had an ex, she would do the same thing. She would be like, so there'd be an actor on the show and they'd be like, I wonder if he's married. And then she'd be like looking through, reading up about his wife, like during the show or whatever. I feel like that's how people watch now.
I try not to get too deeply, if I don't know the person already, I try not to get too deeply involved in their personal life while I'm watching them play a character, because I'm trying to stick with whoever they're trying to play, right? But I will be interested to see if they're like in other shows that I've liked. Really? He played a doctor in that? I'll have to check that episode out again. Like, you know, like different random things. Yeah. Oh, man. I love that. Yeah, that's so good. And then, you know, when you see somebody that, like, you know, and they do well, they're like in a show and you're like,
Oh my God, how are they?
He's the lead in the show. Oh, my God. You know, and of course you can't find their phone number. It is not around. You're all like, surely I can send him a message and tell him how proud. Nope, I have no connection.
I've definitely done that.
I'm definitely not. Yeah,
no. Definitely that. Like, see somebody on TV and they're like, they have one scene and then they get killed by the bad guy or something. And I'm like, good job, man. I saw that. You handled that well. You know?
You know, it's funny. I got into theater because of my Uncle Joey, who is an actor in LA. And so he's in tons of stuff like that. And everyone in our family, everyone, like, calls him and sends him messages when he's on random little things. Like, you'll see him and he'll be like, I just watched your Law and Order again. You were great. or like, oh man.
I would love to get those phone calls.
Like, it's fun. I mean, it's just such a funny thing. But I can't imagine. I mean, it's good to know that you would like to get those phone calls. Because sometimes I feel bad when I'm like, I finish watching him in something and I'm like, I can't believe you said that to her. I just watched that episode of such and such. And he's like... He's like, okay, well, I did. And I was like, you're such a bad guy. He's like, yeah, that's the thing. Oh, man. Oh, so funny. So what is the creative thing that you are excited about right now? Like, you know, you worked on Heartbeats and, you know, maybe you're trying to find how to make self-tape more fun, you know, but what's the thing that's, you know, burning the fire of creativity in you right now?
So I usually go, I feel like, back and forth between there being, you know, a major project that I'm excited about or a major skill that I'm excited about trying to acquire. Right. So, you know, partly right now I'm kind of looking forward to things opening up and kind of figuring out what the new landscape is going to be and what's possible and all this stuff. That's kind of one thing. But right now, so for example, you know, I'm in a improvising Shakespeare course that I've been in for like a year. And so, so all of the skills that are required for that have been what I've been most motivated by lately, you know? So just like trying to, you know, improvise in iambic pentameter at speed, or just knowing the plays enough so that, you know, I am taking tropes without taking full plot structures as a whole, you know, being able to, you know, rhyme on cue. I'd like to learn how to sing this year. That's my next short-term goal. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so right now I'm in the skill building phase, I think.
Yeah. I think that that's a good phase to be in right now. I feel like with theaters being all but closed, it is good to be developing skills.
Yeah.
The other reason that it's good to be developing skills is you're talking about what the landscape is going to be when it reopens. And there's been a lot of shifts and changes and closures and whatnot. And it will be interesting to see how, like we were talking about, the sort of hierarchy of the scene and, and how that plays out, how that will change.
I mean, you and I were talking just before this about, you know, the other shoe dropping in terms of artists being able to connect via the internet and exchange information and all that kind of stuff. The whole move of being able to do, you know, improv online and broadcast it on Twitch or broadcast it on YouTube, I think is huge and here to stay. This is not a novel opinion, but for example, one of my groups, we've been putting on this show for the last almost a year, each Sunday night, called The Pug Hour, just a straight, you know, fun montage type show. But every single show we have done, like even the most like sparsely attended online show we've done has is probably close to 10 times the audience we ever had when we did live shows. You know what I mean? So it's kind of like, well, so now you don't have that whole my way or the highway deal with theaters quite as much, because you're like, well, theaters aren't the only game in town anymore, right? You can there's so much more that can be done, and so yeah, so I'm super excited about that part of it.
Yeah, plus the idea of you know, how you can have an audience from anywhere, from all around the world. So, you know, you used to have to cater to the audience that you had and adjust what you're doing, but now you get the audience that's coming to you for your style. So that's, so you don't have to be like, oh, to harken back to our fun metaphor, you don't have to stop using peanut sauce. You just find the people who like it. You got a peanut sauce groups online. You're like, hey, we got this show. It's called We Love Peanut Sauce. We're gonna do it, and there's gonna be a lot of it. So if you're interested in watching that, and they're like, A+. This is why I come to the internet. People say,
right?
You know,
and I think the key there too is thoughtful advertising, so that you are curating that audience too, because like, again, like we were talking about the whole, you know, context collapse kind of thing, is like, you know, people love to get mad, so you want to make sure that you are letting them know exactly what kind of show they're in for, so they can show up and be happy, you know.
The part of me inside just likes to think, like, I just want to open up a show and just be like, hi, let me tell you why you're going to get mad.
This show is going to piss you off so much. But, a good example of that, or maybe the opposite of that. So Annie O'Connor, who you had on your show, I remember watching her and her husband, Levin. They had a group called Now. It was a two-person show. And I remember at the beginning of the show, they were asking for a suggestion. And he steps forward and goes, now, you can give us whatever suggestion you want. Whatever word you give us, we will do an hour-long show about that thing. So I want you to think real hard about whether you want to see an hour-long show of whatever it is that's bouncing around in your head right now. And everything, like, that's a great way to, like, you know, like, let the audience know, like, yeah, you know, it's funny to, you know, poop, but like she's giving them space to be like, we want to make sure that we give you the show that you want to be here for, you know. I feel like it worked.
You're like, all right, guys, everyone's in agreement. We're doing a poop show. You guys are into this?
Cool. You said it. Now it's going to happen.
All right. We will give you what you would like. That seems fine. We are just the genie in the bottle. Whatever.
Yep. I remember being in the audience at UCB Franklin years ago. And same thing. Somebody gave this suggestion of, you know, a toilet overflowing with feces or something. And they dutifully went and did that whole Herald beat by beat by beat by beat. And I was like, cool, this is what you get. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, man. Don't ask us to make jokes about poop. Do you think that we became comedians because we were great at not talking about poop? No. We've been kicked out of many jobs and schools purely for talking about this. We have ready material.
We trained for this our entire life.
Exactly. You think you're you think you're making it hard. You're actually making it the easiest it could be. The only other option would be if you were to say, do a show about improv.
Be a show about being poor in Los Angeles. Oh, I got this. Everyone can back off. I'll do this right now.
Parental disappointment. Oh, okay. Well, okay. We got this. Seems fine. Parental disappointment. Are you kidding me? Okay. I mentioned that I do this full time? Okay.
A 7-part, 3-hour segment. Yeah.
Oh, man. Cool. It's been really great chatting with you. I'm really fascinated with like just the way your mind works and the way you're like soaking up knowledge, you know, like that seems to be your thing. And I really love that. Like, I appreciate the idea that like when you go and take classes at Impro, you're like reading all about it and you're just like soaking up all the information. And like you said, my goal is to learn how to sing. And I'm like, I wonder what books he's got. Like, you know,
seriously. I've got an Amazon wish list full of like, you know, voice in the actor, bringing your best voice, all that stuff. And it's too much. I gotta balance it. I know that's a that's a thing to work on.
Well, maybe try like an audiobook for the singing.
Right.
Just to throw out there. There's technology for everything, you know?
and obviously I love the fact that, you know, with improv it's a mountain with no summit, right? You can just keep optimizing and learning and getting better forever.
Yeah. And also like we're talking about with the pyramid, it's just, you know, every time you get to the top of the pyramid, you're like, wait, there's another pyramid on top of this pyramid. What are you talking about? Like, it's there's no, you know, if you become the person who's taken every class in every country across the world, write a book, like get that down. Because currently improv is sort of a loose art form that is only vaguely noted in the sort of historical record. And, you know, that's kind of one of the other things that I'm kind of hoping this podcast becomes, is like a legit historical record of like different points of views when it comes to improv and theater. Because, you know, improv is like every single person you talk to has got a different, oh, this is the first group. Oh, well, this is who started it, you know, and vaguely people will stay close to like Viola Spolin and that crowd. But then there's people who are like, well, technically, and then there's the Commedia dell'arte people. So it's like way crazy, you know, like they're like, but isn't that improv? And I'm like, it kind of is improv. Like, you know, so it's like, how did this thing? So
is that the part that fascinates you the most, is like that sort of primordial ooze of improv?
Kind of. I mean, I like the idea of where... I like when an art form is born of a reaction to something else. And so I'd be interested to... I wish that there was like... I know there's a few books of the early stages of a few places, like the committee and whatnot. But like, part of me is like, there's got to be some kind of show that people were forced to do, or that they felt like was their only option. And then they were like, but I don't want to do this anymore. I want to do this other thing. And yeah. potentially inspired by, like, legitimately Commedia dell'arte saying, like, yeah. well, you know, they just used vague tropes. Couldn't we do that? Yeah. And then it's almost like when we were talking about earlier with, like, level one improv. You start with a bunch of rules, and then you kind of yeah. let those rules go. Yeah. Right. So like with Commedia dell'arte, you work with tropes and existing characters. But like, what if you tried that at first? And then when you got used to that, you kind of let those guys go and you tried to create new characters. Well, then that becomes improv. Right. Yeah. And
I mean, I think it's tough, too. I think is that part of the problem with that, the historic looking at it with the historical lens is that, you know, the actual actors in the history rarely know when they are in a historical moment. Like there are some people I feel like who are constantly trying to be in a historical movement. Do you know what I mean? Like they're like, yeah. Oh, I'm pioneering this new thing that no one else is doing, this kind of thing. And there are people that they did something and then this thing got a laugh. So they did that a little bit more and then they did a little bit more. And then all of a sudden they look up 5 years later and their style is way different than everyone else's. And it reminds me of like, I don't know, like the development of like say hip hop or something, right? Like, you know, 90% of the people involved in the beginning of hip hop were just going to parties and listening to DJs and trying this record instead of that. They weren't like, oh, we're going to start a new cultural paradigm here. They were doing what people responded to and what made them happy. And I feel like so much of the development of improv is like that. The people that are doing, I think, the most fun and exciting work are not doing it with one eye on their legacy. You know what I mean? They're just trying connect with their scene partner and have fun and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And then people are drawn to them because they like playing with this person. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's tough to pull all those strings out.
No, you're totally right. And you couldn't be more on point with the, and also even bringing back the ego thing that I had brought up earlier. Mm. Improv is so a fight against ego. It's so a fight against legacy. I mean, the whole point is to forget and move forward. Why would there be a legacy? So the idea that improvisers are not great at recording what their history is, I mean, I guess it's kind of what I should have assumed, right? They're making it up as they went along. They weren't writing anything down.
That's what makes the actual histories when you get that down. That's what makes it so fascinating. But it's a tricky project, no doubt.
Yeah, so crazy. Well, thank you for being on the podcast, and thank you for being in the moment with me. I felt like I had a great time with you.
Absolutely. Yeah, I don't know. Thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed myself quite a bit.
Great. Awesome.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast. Check out all our episodes on yesbutwhypodcast.com or check out all the content on our network, HC Universal, at hcuniversalnetwork.com.